Are you gonna play the intro, or are we just gonna?
I just don't understand if it's Caucasian, why it's not the Caucasus region.
Caucasus, oh my god! It like gives me the heebie-jeebies. It's Caucasus. Caucasus. How have you studied the world and like Caucasus? That's what you sound like. You sound like a bird.
That's a very hard first syllable.
It's like a caucus. It's like a whatever. Just play the intro music. I'm over it.
It's just such a weird little spot of the world.
I think it's an overlooked spot of the world. I don't think it's a weird spot of the world. I think it's a spot of the world that the West doesn't think about very much. But it's big on Russians' mind.
All right. I'm going to roll the intro.
Tear down this wall.
In the 1980s are now calling to ask for their foreign policy back because, you know, the Cold War has been over for 20 years.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has launched a major military operation against Ukraine.
It was the worst day on Wall Street since the crash of 1987.
Britain is no longer part of the European Union.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists.
China is looking to lead a new world order that better aligns with its political views and interests.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
We have never had a century without great power conflict of some kind.
Gosh, I forgot how sick our intro is.
It's not bad.
Okay.
It's not bad.
So, Caucasus and Eastern Europe, you know, close to Russia. Did you see, we were talking about Prigozhin a couple episodes back and his rebellion. We also, I think, talked about his death, right?
Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah.
Did you see what Putin said, what Putin claimed was the reason for why his plane blew up?
Well, not only is Putin the world's most famous dictator, he's also the world's foremost private investigator. And he's given us the definitive proof of how Prigozhin died.
So you did see this. He goes on stage. Somebody asks him at some event, like, you know, it's really, really suspicious. Like, why did this happen? What do you think was the cause of it? And Putin goes, you know, they probably just got really drunk on their plane and were playing with hand grenades and it exploded the whole plane.
And there was, and the other line was, there was no proof of external impact. Okay.
You're right. It is circumstantial evidence. He only tried to overthrow you, an authoritarian dictator, and then, you know, right after he was stopped,
his
plane blew up. Yeah, you're right. He definitely got drunk and was playing with hand grenades, as one does on an airplane. Well, you might get drunk on an airplane.
To be fair, if you're like a Russian private military contractor, maybe you do.
So sure, maybe you do, but like the fact that the head of state that could is probably being accused of killing him, is definitely accused of killing him, throws that out there as the most probable explanation. Hey, maybe he bugged him. Maybe Putin was not lying because he bugged Prigozhin's plane and had info leading up right to the explosion. Or maybe he shot it down. I don't know. We'll never know.
Who knows? But speaking of Russia, Soviet Union, I think we should move into our first topic here. I wanted to talk about Armenia and Azerbaijan and the recent takeover of the Nagorno-Karabakh region by the Azerbaijanis. Maybe we can start with a little background on Armenia and Azerbaijan, how they're related to the Soviet Union, and I can throw up a map. I think that knowing where this is at in the world is also helpful. So
let me share that. And the geography of this topic is important. Very important.
Right. So
you're just Google Mapsing it.
Yeah, I've got the Google Maps up. We can switch. We'll switch to the other one, but I just wanted to do. I think the, like the broader zoomed out is helpful because this is like kind of. I mean, it's pretty close to the Middle East too, which is obviously a hot topic at the moment. But just to get a general understanding, so Azerbaijan, Armenia are kind of the land bridge between the Black Sea and this is the Caspian Sea, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
on the other side of the Caspians, you have, and I just love saying it, the Stans. Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan. Wow, I didn't even know about Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan. I'm not Kyrgyzstan. Saying
that. Yeah.
The heartland of Eurasia. But the left side of the Caspians is called the Balkans. No. Yes. The southern Balkans, right?
I thought the Balkans were up here. Oh. This is the Baltic Sea.
No, not the Baltic, the Balkans.
Yeah. Wait, where is...
Okay, so this is why we're unqualified statesmen. We are learning about our geography on the Balkans.
The Balkans is like Bosnia, Herzegovina, like...
The Balkans are on... Okay, I'm also wrong, though. The Balkans are on the other side of the Black Sea. So the Balkans are... Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, Serbia. That's the over there. That's the Balkans. And then Caucasus are okay.
This region. Side of the
Black Sea. Yeah. The Caucasus are the east of the Black Sea, the other side. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. Quick geography lesson. Very important.
Well, I mean, jokes aside, I didn't know that and I should have. But like that is, as we were talking about before the intro. This whole region is very overlooked. I think a lot of educated Americans can point out Israel and Turkey and Saudi Arabia, but like, would you be able to tell? I would probably have to look at a map even to find Azerbaijan, you know?
Here, so really, so we got our little land bridge. But okay, I think we should, let's do a little background on the two.
Region? Say the name of that region again that we're talking about. Because that's the important one. Show where it is. I'm not trying to get you. I don't know how to pronounce it. That's
Caucasus. So.
No. The region in Azerbaijan.
Okay. Here we go. So this is a map of Armenia, Azerbaijan. They, like we were just looking at Google Maps, they are kind of like a land bridge between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. And... So there's this disputed region between the two countries called Nagorno-Karabakh, which we can see here. It's kind of like isolated within Azerbaijan. It's like a little enclave. And it's been a dispute. It's been primarily made up of ethnic Armenians for 30 years. But the Azerbaijanis have wanted to control the land since then. And they've kind of been
notably lost. Yes. Not connected to Armenia at all.
Well, so there's like, there's this little corridor, right? Like there's like basically a transportation route that you can go back and forth, but it's realistically, it's kind of closed off.
Yeah. I think in case people aren't following, Armenia and Azerbaijan have been at loggerheads for decades. There's a lot of ethnic tension and outright, claims of ethnic cleansing on both sides throughout history and recently. So there are two, not just states, but two ethnic groups that do not get along at all.
Yeah. So both of these countries were part of the former Soviet Union. So when Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, they each formed they were able to form their own governments, their own state. So Armenia is primarily a Christian nation and Azerbaijan is majority Muslim. Interestingly, like this, it's the conflict between the two really is not religious based. It's really just primarily geography
and ethnicity.
Ethnicity. And this Nagorno-Karabakh
geography stems from ethnic hatred. I think, right? Would that be accurate?
I think that would be accurate. Yeah. So. There have been clashes over this Nagorno-Karabakh region for a long time. I mean, realistically, since the fall of the Soviet Union, but it recently came to a head where a couple weeks ago, at the end of September, beginning of October, the Azerbaijani government basically made a decision that they were just going to completely take over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. And so they essentially launched a military offensive, and the Armenian government made a decision that they weren't going to fight. And this was largely because the Azerbaijanis had put the Nagorno-Karabakh region under a blockade for, I think it had been well over a year at this point. So the Armenians who were there, just they didn't have supplies, they didn't have resources.
I think it was just shy of 1 year. It was 9 or 10 months, yeah.
Something like that. And the Armenian government didn't have a way to move weapons or supplies or troops into Nagorno-Karabakh without probably a significant amount of casualties because of the blockade and because the Azerbaijanis were already moving in. So they just, the Armenian government basically just made a decision of, we're just not going to fight this. It's not worth it. And so I think that the actual war, if you want to call it a war, lasted all of 72 hours. And the Armenians who were living in this Nagorno-Karabakh region just fled. And I think it was upwards of 100,000 Armenians who were living.
Which is like 2/3 or 80% of the population of Nagorno-Karabakh have fled to Armenia. So Armenia, which has a population of about 3 million, is struggling to handle all these refugees from Azerbaijan, from Nagorno-Karabakh. But the predominant ethnicity in Nagorno-Karabakh, say that 5 times fast, was Armenian. And this history is important because that region has fallen under Azerbaijan, is part of their territory, and I think it was an agreement in the early 90s brokered by the Russians. And the way it's worked is that region has kind of operated mostly autonomously from Azerbaijan, taking their cues from Armenia, but it has been technically part of Azerbaijan. So it was kind of my interpretation, Azerbaijan is like, okay, this is our territory, but they didn't control it. So it was an insecurity or a concern for them. But now they blockaded that area, did this military operation and hit military targets. And all these Armenians are fleeing because they're afraid of the ethnic cleansing. A lot of international observers have called it ethnic cleansing, or the want for ethnic cleansing that the Azerbaijanis were doing or trying to do in Armenia. And I think the tool they were trying to use that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the tool they were trying to do was famine, was just make sure that Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh couldn't get food. And so this has created a huge refugee crisis, not to mention that region was promised autonomy, and it's kind of a carve out for the Armenians in Azerbaijan.
I do think it's worth pointing out that this is pretty much a case closed example of ethnic cleansing, because the purpose of the Azerbaijani government was to push the Armenians who were living here out, and they have done that. And that's sort of, I think words do still matter. The news and international media likes to be alarmist about things, but this is quite literally ethnic cleansing. Ethnic cleansing is defined by the UN as basically forcing out a group of people because of their ethnicity from the geographic region that they have ties to.
Killing. And then that gets into genocide. And I think that was where is this genocide, or is this,
Ethnic cleansing,
has it crossed that line into genocide? And some are claiming, because of the famine and the lack of food that and the blockade that Azerbaijan had around Nagorno-Karabakh, that was their intention. But, a lot of people are suffering. Many have died. But whether it's reached that fairly high, unfortunately, high threshold of genocide is Some international observers are claiming that it is, some aren't. It's terrible either way, and it's kind of getting challenged. Armenia is challenging Azerbaijan in the Hague, the International Court of Justice, at the UN in the Hague in Netherlands. But whether that goes anywhere, you know, the Hague has no, you know, force behind its determinations. So
yeah, I think so. It's worth also discussing the sort of intricate geopolitics at play here. So like we said, Azerbaijan and Armenia were both part of the former Soviet Union. What's kind of interesting about how the alliances here have shaped out is, so originally Armenia was much more closely allied with Russia. And the Azerbaijanis were very closely aligned with the Turks and Turkey. So as you can see on the map, Armenia lies between Azerbaijan and Turkey, and because of Armenia, Turkey doesn't have direct access to the Caspian Sea, which for them is sort of I think there's a little bit of a geopolitical imperative there to have access to that, you know, large body of water. And so they kind of had an interest in supporting the Azerbaijanis to have more access.
Like there's huge economics benefits to having access to and ports on any kind of body of water, preferably a body of water that's connected with the larger oceans, which the Caspian Sea is not. But that's why usually when you look at landlocked states like Armenia or Mongolia, they are not doing as well economically. And that's why a lot of conflict and concern is over, like, go over to Crimea. Why is Crimea so important to the Russians, right? It's because that little spit of land there, Sevastopol, especially that port, that gives them access to the Black Sea. That's a warm water port. That means it's a lot easier to put ships into and commune with, and military as well. And the Black Sea is not locked, right? You can go through the Dardanelles Straits in Turkey and get to the Med, and then from there to the wider world. So,
which is the important part, right? Because essentially access to the Black Sea means you have access to the Atlantic Ocean, which means you have access to the world. So
I'm going to zoom back into the Balkans, or sorry, the Caucasus. Now that we know the difference, look at, where is it? Oh yeah. Go on the west side of the Balkans. This is off topic, I know, but look at Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. Look at Croatia. It kind of cuts off Bosnia from getting to the water, except for that one little, that's another thing, but
interesting.
Except for that one little split, right? Like coastline is valuable. Sorry. Got way off topic from
and
way
super off. Super side check. But going back to Armenia, Azerbaijan, you know, I just pointing out, Turkey sort of has his vested interest in being able to access the Caspian Sea, because then it gives him access to Iran, to Turkmenistan, to Russia, you know, whereas like right now that, you know, Armenia being in the way and not being an ally means that they just don't have that direct access. So you kind of have this makeup where you have the Turks supporting the Azerbaijanis, you have the Russians originally supporting the Armenians, and, you know, Armenia and Azerbaijan have basically been in a state of conflict since the fall of the Soviet Union, and that's kind of ebbed and flowed over time. It's escalated and de-escalated. There's been tentative peace and those sorts of things. The Armenians, over the course of that time, had increasingly aligned themselves with the West, and that sort of, over the course of that has kind of, you know, pissed off Putin, which has meant that he has over time moved away from being supportive of the Armenians, which having that Russian support is what allowed Armenia to kind of hold out in this like Nagorno-Karabakh issue and some of the fights, because it was, you know, it's a chessboard. The Azerbaijanis are looking like, well, you know, if we go too far, then the Armenians might pick up the phone and call Putin, and then we have to deal with Russia, not just Armenia. Right. And so it creates all of those sorts of issues. But because Armenia had moved closer to the West, Putin had moved away from them, which then had really is what led us to where we're at now, which is Azerbaijanis basically identified that there was a window and that they could just take this region, push all the Armenians out of Nagorno-Karabakh, and Russia's preoccupied with other things, and they're not feeling super great about Armenia at the moment, so they're not going to intervene. And boom, now we're where we're at. You have potentially 100,000 Armenians who've been ethnically cleansed, and hopefully not more military
forced out of their homes and their area. And, you know, Armenia has to deal with the aftermath too, and especially in terms of refugees. I think some of the West are providing aid, including France, the U.S., and at least France and the U.S. are providing aid to Armenia to help with that refugee crisis. But it's kind of ironic, and I'm laughing at it because it's like, of course you are. I'm laughing at it, not as like it's a funny thing, but in a like ironic thing. Azerbaijan's leader says his country is now ready to hold peace talks with Armenia. It's like he's achieved all his goals, you know, and forced people out and like taken back this region essentially. He's like, okay, I'm ready for peace talks now, you know.
I got everything I wanted.
Which is what he wanted. And as we said, like there was conflict in 2020 that was then peace talks were brokered by Russia between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and then this is springing up again. So yeah, it's something that we wanted to talk about, I think, because I didn't see any reporting on it. You know, if I hadn't been. Yeah. So something to keep in mind, and realistically, nothing will probably come of it. The world is distracted between Ukraine and Israel right now. That's taking, I think, most of the bandwidth of the, you know, the conversations, the geopolitical conversations of Western countries, as well as I think the leaders and security forces.
Yeah, I think that's right. So with that, I think we can, I'm going to shift our map here and we can pivot to Israel. And
I kind of like, we should do this map on the screen the whole time. I kind of like having the map up.
The maps are good. People underrate geography.
We had a class, and I know we're about to get into deep subjects, so I want to get this out. We had a class that we took, and the teacher, it was like an international politics class or something, and the teacher made us draw by hand entire regions of the world for homework, and you weren't allowed to sketch it. You could pull it up, and you could draw it by hand, and then I think it was quizzes, too. There were some quizzes where then you had to reproduce those sketches of, and you didn't have to get it all right, but you did have to kind of get the topography of it right.
You need to get the like general sentiment of knowing that, you know, like if you have to draw the Middle East, then okay, Iran is here, Iraq is to the west, Syria is here, and then
borders, are they landlocked, you know, where are major parts of them? Yeah, and that's because when we talk about world politics, geography matters.
Geography is really important.
We call it geopolitics.
Yep.
And not just where countries are, but where mountain ranges, where rivers, where oceans are. Anyway, speaking of regions.
Yeah. So I think the last episode we talked about, you know, there were these horrific Hamas terrorist attacks and an incursion into southwestern Israel. I think it's helpful to take a look at the map to understand a little bit more of how this all works and why this was such a big deal. So Hamas is a political terrorist organization that governs the Gaza Strip. So Gaza Strip is a small piece of land on southwestern Israel that originally was supposed to be part of, you know, the Oslo Accords or different other peace accords to be included in what would become a Palestinian state. It unfortunately has not become that because of there's a million reasons why, but a big piece of it is this Hamas component. So in 2006, the Israelis completely pulled out of this region, the Gaza Strip. Before that, they had sort of military checkpoints. There were Israelis who were living here as well. And as part of some of the agreements that the Israeli government made with the Palestinians, they completely pulled out.
What year was that?
That was 2006.
Okay.
So approximately 18 months later, so 2007, 2008-ish, this group, Hamas, they took over government of Gaza. And to be clear, they won in an election. So they were elected by the people of Gaza. Did the people in Gaza really have much of a choice? I think that's the thing that's, you know, worth more discussion. It's, you know, like I said, it's a political terrorist group. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Like, was it fairly new starting back then? And
it wasn't new. So Hamas was formed, I believe, in like the late 80s, early 90s. They are somewhat a sub branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, which we'd have to go really, really into Middle Eastern history and understanding, you know, the formation of a lot of the Arab governments and sort of pan-Arabism. And there's a lot to unpack there. Just for the purpose of this conversation, I'm going to kind of focus on Hamas and Israel and what's going on here. But so Hamas formed late 80s, early 90s. And so they'd been kind of operating in Gaza and sort of going for more, like credibility and legitimacy. And by being selected to become the government of Gaza, they kind of like earned this. Well, Hamas's sort of stated goal, not sort of, it is like in the charter of this group, is that part of the purpose of their existence is the destruction of the state of Israel. It's not the creation of a Palestinian state. It's not full support of, you know, the Palestinian. It is actually, we exist to destroy the state of Israel. That is very clearly there.
What is the status of Hamas in the West Bank? Can you briefly?
Hamas, there are pockets of people who are, you know, related to and work with Hamas in the West Bank. So this is the West Bank here. This area that borders Jordan on the east, and then of course borders Israel on the west. Then you have the kind of, you have Jerusalem here, which also, you know, contested, and there's a lot to get in there as well. But so the West Bank is primarily controlled by a group called the PA, or the Palestinian Authority, which is supposed to be, was supposed to be the government of the Palestinian state. The leader of the PA is a guy named Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas. He has been in power for 20 years now, and he's pushed off elections for...
That makes sense, yeah.
I want to say like 10.
Definitely have 20 years cycles. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, and the whole thing, I mean, like, right, so Hamas is controlling Gaza, you have the Palestinian Authority controlling the West Bank. These two groups, very straightforward, they don't like each other, right? Because what they're basically fighting to be recognized as the sole leadership of the Palestinian people. So you have at the top level, you know, there is conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians and disagreements about land and who should control what and like what is rightful and these sorts of things. But then within that, right? So like you go on the Palestinian, you have factions fighting for who actually represents the Palestinian people and who should be in charge and who makes, you know, leadership decisions and who gets to negotiate and all of these things. Anyways, come back to Gaza, right? So, wow. So it's been 2 weeks now. So 2 weeks ago to the day, Hamas conducted a military invasion of southwest Israel. They termed the operation Al-Aqsa Flood. This is something that a lot of the Palestinian terrorist movements do this a lot, and actually a lot of the like extremist organizations based in the Middle East, they highlight the Al-Aqsa Mosque as a sort of rallying cry. There's this, they like to put forth this idea that the Israelis are taking over the Al-Aqsa Mosque and that Muslims don't have access to it, and therefore it should be a focal point of resistance and
can you zoom in a little bit on where
destroying the Israeli state. So just to show on the map, so the Al-Aqsa Mosque is here in the east city of Jerusalem. It's this is a photo of it. I mean, everyone is familiar with this. It's the iconic, you know, golden dome. Honestly, it's a beautiful building. I've actually been there, and it's the reason it's highlighted as its focal point is Al-Aqsa Mosque is considered the third holiest site in the religion of Islam. The followers of Islam believe that this is where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven to be with God. And so it's very important to, you know, to all Muslims, all followers of Islam. It's a very, you know, it is an important part of their religion. And so that's because of that, that is part of why it is highlighted by these extremist groups as a sort of rallying cry, because they play on this idea of you need to protect, you know, the holy sites, and there is an enemy who is trying to take over the holy site, or who's trying to control it, or who's trying to destroy it, which is just completely not true. That is a completely fabricated lie. The Israelis have no interest in destroying Al-Aqsa, in completely, you know, in invading Al-Aqsa. I mean, it's just like not the truth at all. There is a subsection of extreme religious extremists, similar to how there's religious extremists in Islam. There are religious extremists in the Jewish tradition as well, who they want to rebuild, or I guess they want to build the third temple. There's a history lesson on Jewish religion there, but those people, I mean, maybe, you know, like they do have some interest in controlling that area, but it's a very, 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 very small subsect of, you know, Jews or Israelis. But coming back to Al-Aqsa, so it uses this rallying point, and going back to the name of Al-Aqsa Flood. So that's kind of the small history lesson on why it's, you know, like that's why they use it. But so Al-Aqsa Flood, Hamas had been planning this for 2 years, I think, is kind of what we're learning and understanding now. And so their military incursion went as far north as Ashdod, as far east as Beersheba. I mean, this is a significant amount of like area to cover. And now we're up to, I think the confirmed numbers are 1,400 plus Israelis were killed. There were more than 40 countries from around the world who had citizens that either died in the attacks or are currently being held hostage in Gaza. And now we're at a point where the Israeli government they've stated that their goal is to completely destroy and dismantle Hamas. And what everybody thinks that means is that there's going to be a full-scale ground invasion into Gaza.
They have said there is going to be a full-scale ground invasion. But so far, they have held off from... They were supposed to do that a week ago, last weekend, and that has not yet materialized. I mean, by the time you listen to this, that might have changed. But as of right now, there are significant airstrikes and fighting, but none... And I'm assuming special operations are... Israeli special operations are, you know, I would hope doing their best to get those hostages out. But I don't know. We can talk maybe about, like, was that a strategic move on their part of, like, saying there's a invasion coming and then holding off on it to show restraint, show the world and show the Gazans restraint, or maybe they said there was an invasion coming, so they had negotiating leverage on getting some of the hostages back. We'll probably never know, because one will presume those conversations and those negotiations are happening behind the scenes. And the rest of the world is watching, and from a diplomacy standpoint is pretty involved. Yeah, I think Biden has flown over there a few days ago, right?
Yeah, I think that's what let's recap everything that's happened since then, because...
Yeah, just real quick, what are the highlights of what has happened in the last week since we recorded? Because it has evolved quite a bit.
So the first thing, I think, like high-level leaders, right? So President Biden has been there. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been in the region, basically shuttling nonstop between the leadership of all the countries in the Middle East. Prime Minister of the UK, Rishi Sunak, has been there, I believe.
Thank you for reminding me, because they've gone through so many PMs recently that I forgot who it was. Yes.
Will you survive the lettuce?
About him. We don't hear much about the UK politics anymore. I wonder, maybe on a future episode we can see what they're up to over there. But
well, I think Rishi's kind of like, he kind of seems like the guy who got 100% on like every exam in college, you know? Like,
you're Thor because you could never do that well.
Like, he seems like he's kind of just like a little, like, he's like very smart, very nerdy, very quiet, very non-controversial.
Maybe that's what you need as a good leader, you know? Like, there's a lot happening, and there's been a lot of, you know, even from especially from countries that have been very strong in their support of Israel, like the U.S., at least the U.S. government has been very strong in their support of Israel. There's been a lot of international interest in making sure the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is kind of handled well or better than it. So Israel cut off all food, water, electricity to Gaza.
Which, to be clear on that, right, like, the Israelis provided something like approximately 10 to 20% of the supply of the Gaza Strip's electricity and water support. The other, you know, more than majority percent is supposed to be provided by their government, which is Hamas. But their government is, one, inept, two, a terrorist organization. So instead of supporting their people and building
extremely correct.
Yeah. Also, yeah, right. Instead of, you know, building infrastructure and creating, like, you know, a more sustainable, flourishing society for their people, they just take all the aid money that they can get, and, like, anything that they can get their hands on in Gaza that can be basically turned into a weapon, they do. Like, they quite literally dig up water pipes to re-weld them into rockets that can be shot at the Israelis.
I want to...
Like...
Also, it's like they... There is a... There has been multiple attempts to reinvigorate their economy, on not just infrastructure, but economy. I just keep laughing at a TechCrunch headline recently, like, oh, the Israeli, you know, actions have cut off the thriving tech sector in Gaza. I'm like, what thriving tech sector? Because I'm sure there are people who were technologically oriented, but, like, they are... Like, there's a lot of civilians who are just struggling to get basic needs met and have enough to live. You know, it wasn't and it's because organizations like Hamas are sucking the life out of it. But then my favorite thing was the stat they pointed to was, oh, yeah, the thriving tech sector worth $10 million. Like, $10 million in tech is, like, nothing. It's like...
That's not even or Series A round, full round. Like,
no, I'm like, what are you, like, you're disproving, like, they buried that fact five paragraphs in, but I was like, you're disproving your own, anyway.
I will say, okay, on that though, I do think it's worth noting, the Palestinians, amongst the broader Arab world, they're one of the most highly educated Arab groups.
Really?
Even within, like Gaza.
Do they, because there's universities there, because there's a good school system there, or because they are able to go into Israel or surrounding countries and get that?
So, like we've talked about, there's so much history here to unpack. But so the Palestinians have received a disproportionate amount of aid to the size of their population, right? Like, if you, I'm not making a political assessment of who. I'm just saying, like, just quite clearly. If you look at the size of the population of the Palestinians and the amount of aid that they've been able to pull, and that money has to go somewhere.
From Israel, that comes from the West, that comes from Iran,
all around the world, a lot of Arab countries. Okay. It comes from the U.S. Yeah. It comes from the UN, all sorts of places. Well, their government is very corrupt, and so most of that money doesn't end up where it's supposed to. But not all of the money ends up in the pockets of the politicians, you know, in Gaza, the West Bank. And some of it, they have to figure out something to do with it. And so that's turned into, they've actually put money into their own, like, sort of university systems and educating their people. And so they're actually very educated, that's a good thing, right? Like, you want to educate your population. You should do that. Some of the problem with their education system is that it's very biased, the people living in, there actually is, like, there is this, like, sort of sub community of Palestinians living in Gaza that work as, like, remote software engineers, like, contractors.
What is the population of Gaza?
Gaza population is, like, 2.2 million.
So what we're trying to say, I guess, is there's a opportunity for a flourishing economy here if they can get a terrorist organization away from controlling the region.
Like, yeah.
And I think a lot of Gazans, I don't want to make a blanket statement because Hamas has a lot of support from civilians as well, but there's a lot of people who don't want to be in this position and don't want to be sheltering a terrorist organization and be that. So there's a lot to unpack here, but currently as it stands, Egypt, there's a humanitarian corridor into Egypt, and Netanyahu said that food and aid can be moved into Gaza from Egypt, right? Egypt borders Israel and borders Gaza at that western edge. If you zoom in a little here, you'll be able to see it.
Which I do want to be clear about this. So the United States has been one of the primary backers and negotiators of being like, hey, like we want to make sure that humanitarian can get in. You know, like we don't want the Palestinian people to be forced into a famine and, you know,
yeah,
ethnically cleansed. But the Egyptian government, were the like sort of the most opposed, like they didn't want to open the border crossing. It's just Rafah border crossing here. They didn't want to allow supplies in. They didn't want to allow anybody to move in and out. They're
afraid of an influx of refugees. What is the rationale?
It's some of it is the refugee component. Some of it is there's fear that if Palestinians leave Gaza, that they'll never be allowed back, that the Israelis won't let them move back in.
The Egyptians didn't even want to let food and medicine in.
They didn't want to let anything in. They wanted to just keep it completely shut.
But like they can not let Gazans out, but they can medicines in. I don't understand. Are they trying to make it keep it closed off so that Israel continues to look like the bad guy for?
There's probably an argument to be made that that's some of it, right? Is that it's? I think it's sad that the Palestinian people get used as a political cudgel for all of the Arab and Muslim world, right? And a lot of these countries are, you know, they're not gonna go out of their way to make the Israelis look good. So they're not
What else has happened in this conflict since we last spoke?
Yeah, so going back to some other things. So like we said, there have been multiple notable world leaders have been to Israel to speak with the Israeli government about this. And this is because there is concern that if the Israelis invade Gaza, that it could develop into a broader regional war.
And that has not happened.
This has not happened yet.
And I want to highlight that. I'm interrupting you because we were very concerned the last time we spoke, a couple of days after this happened, that a broad regional war would erupt, either from Hezbollah in the north, from Lebanon invading, from Iran getting involved, from even Egypt getting involved, and then the U.S. getting involved, it kind of escalating throughout the region. But that has not happened yet. So that is it's terrible what is happening, but that is a small, happy thing that this has not escalated, at least not yet. And that's also another thing.
Yeah. And I think that's what, you know, all these high level visits and negotiations and stuff going on is they're trying to prevent that from occurring. But so since then, there've been a few significant things. So there's two that you call them strike carrier groups.
Why did balloons just fly up on your screen?
I have no idea.
Strike carrier group triggers balloons flying up.
I guess
he gets really excited about strike groups.
But that's right. Strike carrier group. What you call them?
Strike group.
So two of them have moved.
A carrier is at the heart of a strike group.
Yeah.
And then there's other ships associated. Yeah.
So the Americans have moved two strike groups into the Eastern Mediterranean, right? So that is here.
Is that, I believe, made it there yet? I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's there. It's definitely on the way. If it's
in the Eastern Med that was stationed over there anyway, or
it was
operating over there anyway, and there's another
something,
one.
And then there was one that was closer to France or Spain, I believe.
That's almost there, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and these are stationed here. This is interesting. I don't have the map on me, but if you pull out a map of what is estimated the missile ranges of what Hezbollah has, they put them basically 5 miles outside what they think Hezbollah can reach in terms of getting to the Mediterranean, right? So Hezbollah is based in Lebanon. They're kind of the de facto ruling party, also a terrorist political organization.
Can you go to, while we're on the subject of strike groups, can you go to where the Houthis are?
Yes. So let's move to the Persian Gulf. So on the other side of the Middle East here. And Yemen. So
the Houthis are, again, a quasi-terrorist group based out of Yemen. So very close in the region, but separated by Saudi Arabia, right?
They're largely based, yeah, in this western half of Yemen.
And so they are pretty far away from Israel. I just want to say that. They're pretty far away from Israel. But yeah. They're also pretty close. And a day ago, 24 hours ago, it was announced that a U.S. destroyer shot down two missiles launched from Yemen, launched from Houthi-controlled Yemen. The destination was presumed to be Israel. But first of all, U.S. destroyers, that's what they're designed to do. They're designed to protect other ships like carriers, but also regions of the world from missile strikes. And there's a lot more detail there, but in this case, they were able to shoot down those missiles. Nobody was hurt. End of story. We can talk about like why Houthis were shooting missiles at Israel and everything, but I think the point that the U.S. was trying to make was not only are we moving our carriers there, but we can and will act. And this was a relatively like low stakes of we're going to show that we are present and we are taking action. We're not just moving ships around. We are taking action to ensure stability in the region. And we are demonstrating that if Hezbollah gets involved, if Iran gets involved, because look at where Iran is. You know, they're right on the other side of Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula there. Like, we are here and willing to act. So I think that was the current, you know, the military leaders over there and the political leaders is, of course, in the U.S. directed by the political leaders, showing resolve of like we are not only just here, but we are prepared to act. So, yeah.
Yeah. Which, you know, and I guess now we're just no one is certain where we're going with this. There's concern that if or when the Israelis invade Gaza, that what's going to happen is Hezbollah is going to fully mobilize and attack the north of Israel. And if they do that, the Americans have said that they will support the Israelis with missile defense and just, you know, giving them military support to prevent Hezbollah from, you know, murdering thousands or tens of thousands of Israelis.
Israel has asked for $10 billion in military aid. I think, you know,
it'll probably go through.
Yeah.
Most likely. But then if that happens, there's so many threats being thrown around the region that if, you know, if Hezbollah attacks and then the Americans support the Israelis with these missile defense, then the Iranians are saying, well, then we're going to take that as an act of violence against us, and then we'll be forced to, you know, act further, which we don't know exactly what that means. Maybe that means they try to activate all their terrorist groups across the Middle East, so you have Houthis in Yemen firing missiles I don't know.
I don't want to like get into the too deep into this because it's like it hasn't escalated yet, and I certainly think that it can and maybe even will escalate further. But I think there's intense diplomacy behind the scenes, especially not just from countries like the U.S., but even Iran. I think they issued a press release via the U.N. to Israel.
Yes.
It was kind of de-escalatory. Israel has not commenced that invasion. I think the leaders in all these countries understand what's at stake. And, you know, maybe not Hezbollah, maybe not all these countries, but the big ones, Israel, Iran,
Saudi Arabia,
Saudi Arabia. Like, who's also deeply invested in the region, obviously from location and from the fact that they want to be a geopolitical regional player and they want to oppose Iran. So I think there's intense negotiations happening behind the scenes. And the fact that Israel did not invade Gaza, I see that as somewhat de-escalatory. On the flip side, it's estimated that about the same, if not more, Gazans have died from Israeli airstrikes. So while they are justified and taking actions that need to be done, like, this is not, non-combatant Israelis are no longer the only casualties. There are many civilian Gazan casualties. So I think Israel understands that. And where I'm going with this is A, to point it out, but B, I just want to talk kind of broadly about, like, there's the war and then there's the war of propaganda. And I think this is, throughout history, you look at any kind of war or conflict and there's the actual ground conflict, but then almost not all the time, but a lot of the time, the war that matters more is the war of words. And you saw this with Ukraine on why Putin was justifying its invasion, and then the Ukrainians' response getting couched in terms of democracy and freedom and autonomy. You're now seeing this with Israel as well in this conflict. So there's the big event that we haven't mentioned yet was there was an explosion near or at a Gazan hospital. I think an important point to have is that Hamas has their military headquarters at hospitals. They use humans. They use human civilian shields, which is absolutely atrocious. And so immediately after this explosion, Hamas said 500 people died at this hospital, 500 civilians, and the Israelis did it. And that was the message that got amplified and picked up by Western and Middle Eastern news organizations around the world. There wasn't a lot of vetting to that. A couple hours later, Israel finally issued a rebuttal and was able to show proof, or claim they show proof, that it wasn't them, it wasn't their attacks. And then even later on, a video on social media came out of a rocket being fired from Gaza, a Gazan Hamas rocket being fired at Israel, and you see it change direction and come back and land what looks like to be near that hospital. And there's a lot of open source intelligence of the photos of the blast that was apparently in the parking lot and other stuff that are now saying, like, okay, that was not an Israeli munition. That was, it's, the blast pattern is not connecting and size is not consistent with Israeli munitions. There's other factors that, so, but I think I don't want to pass judgment either way because I have my own opinions on who shot the rocket, but I think until we allow the dust to settle and the investigation to happen, nobody really knows who fired that rocket. We don't even really know how many people died in that hospital, how many civilians died, especially because the we're not going to know that, you know? So
it was just, right, the people reporting the numbers is Hamas.
Right. Right. And they want to inflate their civilian casualties to make Israel look like the bad guy. And that's what we talked about on the last episode of maybe this is just a provocation of Israel to get civilian casualties within Gaza, and then the whole Arab world rallies behind Hamas. So I don't want to pass judgment on the actual event and say definitively who did it. I just want to say, look at, for the record, I think Hamas did it, but I'm not saying that definitively. I think it's more of like, you look at the reaction to it immediately. Everybody picks up that narrative of Hamas's narrative. Moreover, once Israel issued that response and the proof that they didn't do it, it didn't matter. You look at the Arab world, especially, it doesn't matter. People believe what they're going to believe. People already believe that Israel did it. And by people, I mean mostly the Arab world and parts of the Western world as well. But my point is that there is this war of words going on, and some people are predisposed to believe others, but I'm not sure that Israel is winning that war of propaganda.
Yeah. I think it's worth noting, and I'm in agreement with most of what you said. I think too, it's just, it's a point to, with all of these things, it's important to be an intelligent information consumer, to exercise some critical thought. We're all subject to biases, and we all have our internal beliefs about things that we want validated because we want to think we're right. And it's worth just waiting to pass judgment.
Right.
You know,
and the rest of the world, I mean, that's how you should be as a social media and media consumer. But the fact is that most of the world is not. And Hamas was able, whoever is truly at fault, Hamas was able to spin it, the narrative in their favor, and kind of poke up more support and outrage across the world against Israel, which is, you know, whether or not that was their original goal for going into Israel and killing innocent civilians and killing babies, I don't know, but it is definitely their goal now. It's a war of provoking the most outrage so that they can get support from their side.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe the last thing we should just cover with this before we wrap is kind of, you know, talk about like where do we go from here? From that, one thing I wanted to point out that I kind of learned recently that's really interesting. So we know that part of the motivation behind these attacks might have been to derail the normalization talks between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
And something, and did they get derailed?
We don't know yet definitively, okay. Right? Like, I mean, they are at least temporarily, they're not going to be happening for sure.
Yeah.
But we don't know if they're completely toast or not. No one knows except maybe MBS. But the thing that I think is interesting that was pointed out to me was that, so MBS himself has this Saudi Vision 2030. It's this long-term strategic plan for the country, economic development, like or modernization, all these things. One thing that's a part of that is creating essentially a land bridge from, you know, the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea to the Mediterranean in terms of trade, flow of goods, flow of people, flow of services. Well, in order for that to happen, the sort of path of least resistance is Jordan, which the Saudis and the Jordanians, they have a great relationship. They get along fine. And then to go through Israel. Right. So, and because Israel itself is sort of a high tech country and it is a hub, they already have like well-established ports. It would make sense for the Saudis to have, you know, essentially like probably from Haifa, which is up here in the north of Israel. You know, you want to have some sort of transport that goes from Haifa all the way down to Dubai, right? So that was something that I guess is like, that's one of the goals or objectives of potentially working out this normalization plan is there's a sort of, there's an immense potential economic benefit for the Saudis to get out of this and part of the broader Gulf region. You know, if you can move stuff from, you know, India, the Indian Ocean, China, all this Eastern Asian region, you know, through here, you'd save some time instead of having to go through the Gulf. You don't have to worry about the Houthis in Yemen, potentially create some more stability for the region.
Well, and Saudi Arabia wants to be a big boy. They want to be the big player in the region.
And they do.
They are to a certain extent, but they're trying to transition to a post-oil. They realize the golden goose of oil will be around for a while, and they're going to make a lot more money off of that, but it won't be around forever, and they're trying to transition to the next stage of their economy and geopolitical clout. MBS specifically is who's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, and basically there is a sovereign who's much older and will probably pass away soon, but MBS is the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. All this to say that I personally think that the geopolitical imperatives going on here are going to keep pushing states to normalize relationships with Israel.
Yeah.
I don't know what the timeline is on that. But there've been a lot of, you know, a lot of people have been saying, well, this is the end of any relationship between the Arabs and the Israelis, like it's game over. And I just don't think that that's very good or sharp analysis.
Well, you see that too in the country. So that we talked about the reporting the war of propaganda, the countries that have normalized relations with Israel from 2020 onward are Bahrain, UAE, and
Morocco, Sudan, Kosovo,
Jordan, right?
Jordan's had normalized relationships with the Israelis for a long time.
Okay, so those countries, right? You look at their reporting and the people that they invite on television to cover this. Countries that have not normalized relations, like Yemen, will invite Hamas spokespeople, right? Yeah. The countries that have normalized relations, like UAE or Bahrain, it's definitely not pro-Israeli coverage, right? They're definitely, you know, they have to walk a tiptoe between supporting what most of the Arab-backed world sees is Palestinians as oppressed and the victims here. But they're not inviting Hamas spokespeople. And they will invite Israeli, you know, they will invite Arabic-speaking Israeli Jews and at least provide that perspective, which I thought was an interesting kind of snippet on, like, that tightrope is still there, and they're not supporting Israel by any means. Quite the opposite. But, like,
it's like evidence of shifting,
yes,
dynamics, shifting tide, and yeah, relationships for the region.
Right. Which is probably, you know, as we talked about last time, what Iran and pushed Iran and Hamas to put resources and planning into actually doing the original attack is because the people, you know, lesser extent can be said about Hamas and the leadership of Hamas, but definitely the leadership of Iran, for all their rhetoric, they have a very long view of things, and they've seen where things were going in this part of the world. So,
yeah,
I think I just want to unpack the word geopolitical imperative for the listeners, because that's a buzzword that sometimes gets thrown around, but that, and we talked about the importance, it's just the importance of geography, as we were talking about earlier, where those barriers and those openings are in the natural geography of the world, as well as where the borders are of countries in relation to those, and how that drives what countries feel they need to do to stay safe and to be economically autonomous and vibrant. And we can think about the globalized world and airplanes and everything and think that, oh, geography does not matter. It matters so much, right? Like, Russia invaded Ukraine in part because of geopolitical imperative to provide a buffer zone against the plains of Europe. They have historically always been invaded from Central Europe, leading through that area, if you go up on the map, through that area in, you know, in Napoleon's case, in Hitler's case, going to all the way to Moscow. Like, Belarus, Ukraine, they come through Poland, you know, the Germans or the French or wherever it has been throughout history, they come north or come east and north and invade through Moscow because that area is very open and it's very easy to march an army through that. And so the Soviet Union had the Iron Curtain through Eastern Germany, and why they created the Soviet Union, and it wasn't just Russia. One of the huge reasons was to create a buffer zone on the heartland of Russia, from protect them from invasion, and similar geopolitical imperatives on worries about invasion and security, worries about where your oil is coming from, where your energy is coming from. These are things that drive modern, very modern, international political decisions. And your argument is that imperative, that force, is pushing towards a more secure and interconnected Middle East. I don't know if I 100% agree with that, because I think the people, the people involved play a huge role. And there's a lot of people who, a lot of countries and actors that have a geopolitical imperative, or at least feel they have a geopolitical imperative to keep the region divided. So I'm not sure I 100% agree with that, but that is an interesting perspective.
Yeah.
And I hope it does become more peaceful and less divided and able to economically flourish. But
I feel exactly the same. I think that, you know, it's like a region that, to me, it just seems like it's the amount of prosperity that there could be is untapped. And yeah. I think it's unfortunate.
Well, on that, I think we should probably wrap. It's been great having you guys. We are the Unqualified Statesmen because we try to, but we definitely don't know what we're talking about, nor know where the Caucasus are or the Balkans. Hopefully you learned something. Hopefully you became a little bit more about the world, aware about the world, and we definitely enjoyed having you. So thank you so much.
See you next time.